Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Paul.
Hello, welcome to Canter. You've got Scott here today with Adam, taking over from Paul for the day. Paul couldn't make this appointment, unfortunately. We've got Dr. Katrina Green on the line. Dr. Katrina Green, welcome to Canter and thank you very much for giving us your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me, guys.
Dr. Green, could you tell us a bit about who you are, what your background is, and what you do with your research?
Yeah, so I'm a senior lecturer in the School of Medicine here at the University of Wollongong, and I'm also a medical researcher. So I've been looking at the endocannabinoid system and the cannabis plant for the past 14 years, and I currently work in our new research institute, Molecular Horizons, and I'm also an affiliate of the Illawarra Health and Medical Research Institute. So my research has been examining the ability of different cannabis compounds to improve brain health. Originally, I was looking at how the cannabinoid system works in the brain to help me to understand how it can actually affect our appetite. So covering a couple of different areas there.
Very interesting. So you're pretty much the perfect person for this episode. We've had a goal from when we started this podcast to try and educate some of our listeners about cannabis and its interaction with the human body and brain, let people know of both the positives and potential negatives that are associated with it. And one thing that we are finding out is there's a great number of people out there that really don't know the basics. And I guess a good place to start would be for you to describe what are cannabinoids, what are terpenes, and what roles do they play?
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting place to be in because I think the true answer is we kind of don't really know. We don't know a lot. Our understanding of the plant is still developing. There was a publication that was put out just a couple of months ago, and it described a whole heap of new enzymes that have been found in cannabis that can actually create terpenes. So, you know, we sort of think we know something and then someone else finds something new and exciting, and you know, in that sense, it's a really exciting place to be. I suppose if we break it down, cannabinoids are what we call C21 terpenophenolic skeleton compounds. And that's basically fancy science way of saying that the cannabinoids are produced by the plant and they all have a really similar chemical structure, but slight differences that give them different properties in the body. So we thought originally that they were classified as the compounds that come from the cannabis plant that the cannabis plant actively makes. And what I mean by that is cannabis has a whole heap of different chemicals in it, and it will convert those chemicals into different cannabinoids. And the way it does that is through these enzymes, cannabinoid synthase enzymes. So the true products of the plant are produced from these enzymes. But what we're finding is that the longer cannabinoids sit in the plant, they naturally convert into other compounds. Yeah, so we call it oxidation. So now we say cannabinoids are not only the thing that the plant actively makes, but also the byproducts of the plant. So there's about 104 different cannabinoids, and we're finding more and more on a monthly basis.
So the enzymes that you speak of that are within the plant, are they also in our body?
Not quite, no. So it's very different. The endocannabinoid system can respond to the products of the plant. Mm-hmm. The plant products are very different.
Okay, interesting.
The plant enzymes, yeah.
So as far as cannabinoids interacting with our body, once we consume these cannabinoids, how does our body uptake them and how do they affect us?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we're trying to still understand, you know, when you consume cannabis, how much actually gets into the body and how much actually gets into the brain. We know that we have receptors in the brain and throughout the body that are called cannabinoid CB1 and CB2 receptors, as well as some other ones that we're also sort of discovering along the way, but they're the two main ones. So, and our understanding of this system is so in its infancy. When I was doing my honours, I was looking at the CB1 receptor, and that was back in 2006. And at that stage, it was absolutely known that there was no CB2 receptor in the brain. So whatever I was looking at had to be CB1. Now we're sort of going, well, actually, that's not right. There's actually CB2 receptors in the brain. And that's just in that sort of short space of time. So understanding the human endocannabinoid system is a challenge and a great place to be. But then understanding how the plant interacts with the human endocannabinoid system is adding that additional complexity to it. So basically, if we narrow it down to kind of THC, THC will enter into the body, it'll enter into the brain, and it will cause effects directly on CB1 receptors in the brain. And that's how it will cause most of its what we call psychoactive effects, so drug effects. Now, when I say drug effects, that can be for recreational purposes, or that can actually be for medicinal purposes. So we're starting to understand that some of the things that we see with cannabis users, some of those things we can actually capitalize on and try and develop new medicines for people who have illnesses that involve imbalances in this endocannabinoid system.
That's really interesting. So you mentioned how little we know at this stage. I can only imagine how difficult it was for you 14 years ago, getting even access to product to test and to research. So can you run us through the evolution that you've seen over the last 14 years from the days where it was highly prohibited, even in a medicinal sense, to where you're at now, and why we are so lacking in information and why it's developing at such a rate now?
So in the Australian landscape, obviously it was not accessible. You know, it was almost impossible to get a hold of cannabis plant material. When even just a couple of years ago when I started working in cannabidiol, 2013, 2014, cannabidiol what is called a Schedule 8 drug, so a super duper kind of, you know, super hard to get. You've got to go through all these approval processes. You can do it. We obviously did it. We got it into the country. But, you know, there were a lot of hoops that we had to jump through. While we were actually running our experiments and producing our publications, it got down regulated to a Schedule 4 drug, which is kind of where we see anti-anxiety medications. So, you know, things you need a prescription for and an actual doctor to give it to you. And now there's talk that we're actually bringing it down to a Schedule 3 drug in low doses where we can actually get it over the counter from a pharmacy. So it's really just even cannabidiol has changed so much as government, I suppose, as everyone's understanding of, you know, this is from the cannabis plant, but it's actually probably more beneficial for you than it is detrimental for you. And it's interesting because cannabis has changed a lot over the years. You know, when there were pot-smoking hippies roaming the earth, spreading sort of free love back in the 60s and 70s, there was a low amount of psychosis that was happening as a result of cannabis intake. And that's because cannabis back then had a lot of this CBD in it. It was quite protective of the brain. So, you know, very loosely speaking, you could kind of smoke whatever you wanted and you know, you didn't have these negative side effects. Now growers are trying to develop these ultra high levels of THC, and they've inadvertently bred down the protective stuff, the CBD. So it's kind of interesting how the cannabis plant has changed over time and our understanding of things has changed over time too.
That's fascinating. I think I'd like to go into that CBD a little bit with you, with the neuroprotective qualities of it. And I guess you are the perfect person to ask about that because you've done so much research into the molecule or the compound, sorry. So are you able to just explain to the listener how it's neuroprotective or how we believe it may be neuroprotective?
Again, how is a big question. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to answer how it's neuroprotective, but what we do know is that regardless of what illness or what paper you pick up, it's always, I shouldn't say always, it's mostly beneficial for most illnesses. So regardless of whether it's an illness of the brain or an illness of the stomach or, you know, an illness of the bones, for example, so arthritis, it's protective of most things. So the thing is that most illnesses have a level of inflammation. So we sort of think of inflammation as like a pulled muscle or, you know, maybe something on the skin that's inflamed. But most illnesses from pretty much obesity through to brain injury through to digestive issues, they've all got these underlying levels of inflammation, and CBD just seems to come in and settle the inflammation. So certainly its anti-inflammatory properties are a important way that CBD is actually protective of the brain.
Yeah, okay. So we've spoken with a Dutch breeder by the name of Dutch Passion a few times now, and we've discussed this where we've discussed that the nature of the demand for cannabis in the past was for the recreational sense. And we spoke about the breeding and the way these breeders were trying to get the highest THC content out of their plant and to minimize the CBD content to maximize the psychoactive effect. And now we're starting to see the breeders acknowledge the modern research through people such as yourself, and they're starting to reverse that trend. Whilst they are still offering varieties that have this high THC content, they're starting to really open up high CBD and low THC strains, and we're hearing that there's quite a bit of support for low THC CBD cannabis to be integrated into society, and they're all for that. So does it give you a bit of positivity seeing that the people that are breeding these varieties are starting to respond to your research?
Yeah, definitely. It's great to see that the high CBD plants are being valued. It's really interesting in some spaces that I move in, their sort of medicinal cannabis industry representatives, but that excludes hemp. And I sort of think to myself, but hemp is the low THC, tends to be higher CBD, which is probably more beneficial for you than what you're thinking is sort of medicinal cannabis in terms of what I do, at least in terms of my brain research. Yeah. But they exclude hemp from being a medicinal cannabis product, and I find that really interesting. So I think, you know, as a society, I suppose as the evidence grows, you know, so will everybody's understanding collectively, you know, from the grower through to the, you know, the pharma company through to the doctors. And we just got to watch this space and keep sort of plugging away at answering the questions.
Very interesting. So also, I guess we have cannabinoids in our trichomes of the plant, but we also have terpenes. Are you able to explain what terpenes are for starters and how they interact?
My God, I love terpenes.
Very cool.
I love terpenes. Terpenes are so underappreciated. So terpenes are actually one of the most abundant molecules on Earth by mass. So they are in every single life form. They're in our eye, for example. So retinol in our eye is a terpene. Cholesterol, which is the fundamental building blocks of cells, are terpenes. But terpenes in plants have been studied since the dawn of time. So since the beginning of human records, terpenes have been studied in medicine, but science doesn't acknowledge it until more recently. So terpenes are traditionally considered the flavors and fragrances that plants produce. And we know that cannabis has this wonderful aromatic profile, and that different cannabis strains can have different sort of flavors and fragrances, and that's to do with the terpene profile. But that's just such an underestimation of what these terpenes can actually do. So things like pinene, for example, which is high in pine oil and high in rosemary and high in certain cannabis chemobars, it's the evidence is showing that it's anticonvulsant in animal models, so in the lab. So that means that we could potentially work further to understand whether it's an anti-epileptic drug. Insomnia, it helps with in people. Analgesic, so it's a great pain relief. Antidepressant, antioxidant, anti-anxiety, anti-this, anti-that. It also helps our brain function, so our learning and our memory. For stroke, so in models of stroke, when you cause massive amounts of brain damage, if you give them pinene to start with, then it actually protects the brain against the brain damage that's associated with stroke. So the evidence is showing that even something like pinene, which we might go into a pine forest and go, gee, that smells nice, and you breathe in the fresh air and you just feel wonderful. Actually, when you breathe it in, it's going to the brain. It's changing the neurochemistry of the brain. So you might have heard of things like serotonin and dopamine that are our sort of feel-good signals in the brain. It actually can change those signaling systems in our brain. And we're only just starting to recognise that actually what's been going on for many, many thousands of years in human history in what we call sort of complementary and alternative medicine actually is a real thing and should be put forward as a traditional medicine approach. Vanilla, for example, which is high in lavender, has all the same properties. You know, it's really interesting with linalool, and the reason I'm so excited about terpenes is because I've just submitted a review trying to call for terpenes to be used more in psychiatry, capitalising on the terpene profile of cannabis plants. But what I found in the literature was that linalool, which is abundant in lavender and sweet basil and also abundant in some of the cannabis chemobars, it causes calming effects in humans, in rodents, in horses, and even in honeybees. So the honeybees that guard the hive, when you give them linalool, they will not respond to attack pheromones and pull the army together to go in to get the swarm to attack. It actually calms down the whole hive by blocking the interest in the attack pheromones of these guard bees, which I just think is fascinating.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I wonder if they're using that as a technique in the apiaries to harvest some honey and get a colony of bees. I wonder if it's being utilised.
Yeah, for sure. So I think our understanding of terpenes is definitely growing, and, you know, I think it will only be a matter of time before we start to appreciate the terpene profiles of cannabis plants far greater than simple flavours and fragrances.
So do you find with these terpenes, I mean, essential oils are making a big sort of scene right now. They're very popular. So there's real world science behind these essential oils and people putting them in their diffusers and inhaling them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the evidence is clear that when humans or rodents or, you know, whatever model you're sort of working in to understand the scientific question, when you inhale, these two terpenes in particular will actually enter into the brain. And it will cause changes in the brain, similar to what we see with, you know, anxiety medications and antidepressant medications. So when you go into the pine forest and you feel good, it's actually, you know, scientifically sound. Your aromatherapy is scientifically sound. But I suppose it poses an interesting question as to why mainstream medicine sort of doesn't, you know, you don't go to the doctor and they prescribe you, you know, lavender oil. And I think it's because when we're dealing with whole plant products, there's a whole heap of different chemistry that's going on there. So there's a reluctance to kind of, you know, even to publish this sort of information, you need to be able to isolate the effect down to a single molecule. So it's not as well accepted in the scientific community and also probably translates to the medical community. if you give sort of a mixture of things and you find an improvement, well, you need to be able to identify exactly what was causing that improvement.
So, Katrina, we've got written down here isolates for discussion with you, and we've hit the nail on the head just there where you discussed in a clinical sense that people would prefer pure isolates rather than full spectrum. Are you able to describe to the listener what isolates are, why they're essential in a clinical or a research sense? And also, could we then go into full spectrum and explain what the difference is and why there may be a benefit to full spectrum as well?
Yeah, so isolates are the traditional way of approaching medicine. So you take a compound and you find out whether that compound is safe and whether it works for a particular disease. So for in some of the work that I've done, for example, we take isolated cannabidiol and we provided it to a rodent model of schizophrenia, and we found that it improved behaviour and it improved neurochemistry in the brain. So this is kind of a very pharmacological approach to trying to understand how to use a substance or how to treat an illness with a specific substance. THC, for example, we know that it can be detrimental for the brain in a lot of situations, but it can also be beneficial. So things like sufferers of PTSD, epilepsy, are some of the things that THC alone is beneficial for. What we're starting to find is that when we use these products in a whole plant extract, sometimes there will be greater benefits than the isolated product. This is referred to cannabis culture as the entourage effect. But basically it comes down to synergism, so synergistic relationships. So basically if you have an illness, illnesses are incredibly complex and there won't be one single underlying reason as to why that illness is occurring in the body. So there'll be a whole heap of different systems that are out of whack. You might have inflammation, you might have, disruptions to chemical signaling in the brain. There's a whole heap of different things. So with all these different imbalances, if you send in one compound, it may have a beneficial effect to a certain point. But if you send in a whole plant extract that can cause multiple different benefits, then it's likely that you're able to treat the illness better just because you've almost sent in an army as opposed to one single person to try and fix the illness. So that's kind of synergistic research. And in plants, synergistic research has been going on for a lot longer than, what we sort of term the entourage effect in cannabis. So it's not new. And it is well recognised, and I suppose we just need to be researching further to see what works for people, what works best for people with certain illnesses, and then try and figure out what's actually in the preparation that they're taking that's helping them. Cannabis is a real disruptor to traditional medicine because, it goes against traditionally you'd get a single compound and you'd use it and you'd test it through all the clinical trials, and then it would go out to market and then you'd actually give it to patients and doctors would prescribe it. But cannabis is such a disruptor because doctors are prescribing things that people are asking for, and they're asking for it because they have a sense that it's going to help them. So everything in the background sort of got to try and catch up to find out what is it in those extracts, the whole plant extract, that makes it so much better for that particular illness compared to the isolated compound.
Katrina, could we ask, THC, it's revered by some and hated by others. Can we go into a bit of detail about THC? Can we describe the basics of THC, then talk about Delta-9 THC? And maybe go into both positive and negative effects of the compound?
Okay, so THC begins as the acidic form and it's converted through almost kind of heat stress and, thermal stress mostly, into THC. This is traditionally the Delta-9 THC. THC has a strong affinity for the cannabinoid CB1 receptor in our bodies and in our brain. Now, because the CB1 receptor is expressed in specific brain regions, it can have specific effects on our body. So, for example, in the hippocampus, which is a region of our brain that we use to learn and remember things, there are CB1 receptors in the hippocampus. So there's a train of thought and some evidence to show that in people who consistently use high THC products, they have difficulties in learning and remembering things. And that's because they're continually bombarding these CB1 receptors with this high THC. Now, if you have, for example, let's flip it. If you have PTSD and you have these painful memories and you're trying to manage whatever's happened to you in the past to lead you to a PTSD diagnosis, it may be that the THC in the cannabis can be beneficial if it interacts with your hippocampus, because that's where you're trying to sort of stabilize your memories and the pain that's associated with those memories. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's something that we've been trying to sort of delve into a bit about the abusive side of cannabis and the people that do abuse it, and that, as you described it, bombarding of the brain. Do you feel there's any way that we can try and perhaps steer a people that are abusing the substance through education away from doing that?
Look, addiction is a really complex issue, and, you know, definitely through education. Like, I think there's lots of people out there who would say, well, it's a natural product. We've got these receptors in our bodies. Obviously, it was meant to be. It's a match made in heaven. But my counter argument to that would be, we have nicotine receptors in our body too, and they do a very certain function. They're actually to do with, you know, the basics of even just movement. Smoking cigarettes does not help us with our movement. So the nicotine that's in the cigarettes is not meant to be in our bodies for a number of different reasons, but also smoking cigarettes is bad for you because of your lungs and blah, 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 and all these other things as well. It causes cancer. And if you don't have an imbalance in a system, why would you put something into your body that causes an imbalance? So I suppose from a very medical cannabis perspective, my belief in the plant is that there are an abundance of compounds that could potentially have benefits on our bodies, not as a vitamin type thing or even for recreational, but if we have imbalances in certain systems, then like any other medicine, the cannabis plant has potential to bring those imbalances back to normal.
Yeah, that's well put.
Yeah, the addiction side of things is very complex, but I think people's understanding of cannabis as being this benign thing, mm-hmm. I think we just need to be a bit careful, because you're putting stuff into your body that changes at least your brain signaling, and I focus on the brain because I'm a neuroscientist. And if you're changing your brain signaling, then there could be negative things that occur as a result of forcing that imbalance.
Yeah, that's well put. That's a really good way to describe it. When we talk about CBD and the anti-inflammatory properties, have you done any research on, arthritis and things like this?
Yeah, so I don't personally research arthritis, but there are certainly articles out there where other groups have looked at arthritis from the very basic form. So, you know, getting cells and seeing how they respond to, so they're called chondrocytes, so the cartilage cells. Arthritis is inflammation of the joints and the cartilage. And so CBD can help to calm down those cartilage cells. You then take it into rodent models of arthritis, and we find that it can improve the inflammation associated with arthritis. And then there are people who are doing clinical trials. Now, the clinical trials are showing beneficial effects, but we need to show that it wasn't just that population of people and it happened to be, you know, I suppose, for lack of better words, a bit of a fluke. So we need to make sure that it crossed different populations. So in some of the work that I've been doing, I find that male and females respond to CBD differently. So we need to consider that males and female bodies are very different in their chemistry, and so they're going to respond differently to different drugs. There's also different age groups. So we might need to be a little bit careful of, you know, giving CBD to the developing brain as opposed to the very elderly brain. So there's lots of different populations that we need to look at in order to be able to answer the questions properly from a clinical point of view.
Yeah, that's fascinating when you mention age and sex, and I guess that paints a picture of how diverse and how complicated this whole thing is. Can we go back to your neuropharmacology profession and talk about CBD in Alzheimer's, things that are degenerative in the brain? Can you tell us if CBD has a positive effect, if we've done any study into these conditions?
Yeah, so it's mostly preclinical at the moment. So again, in cells and in rodent models, we find that, so in some of the building blocks that actually cause the damage in Alzheimer's disease, they're called plaques and tangles. So CBD is able to reduce the development of these plaques and tangles. It also helps with preventing inflammation. So Alzheimer's disease is one of those super complex disorders. So we know that there are plaques and tangles that stop the brain cells from being able to communicate with each other, and that's how we end up with degeneration of function, particularly around learning and memory. But there's also, because of this imbalance, there's also a lot of inflammation that goes with it. There's a lot of brain cell death that goes with it as well. And CBD is able to improve, so it's anti-inflammatory in the brain and it's protective in the brain as well in these models of Alzheimer's disease. In dementia, I believe there are researchers at our university that are actually looking or starting to look at CBD in dementia. We just have to see whether it works in the clinical scenario as well. And dementia is really complex because it's multifaceted. So there's different stages of dementia. So, you know, it might be that we can actually target people who are looking like they might have acquired dementia later on in life and try and prevent it from happening in the first place. Or then there's the other side of it where there's diagnosed dementia and it's chronic and it's been around for a while. Can we actually treat it? So there's sort of two different questions to ask there.
And is dementia linked to this plaque buildup as well?
Yeah, so dementia, meaning a loss of brain cells. So that's sort of what the word inherently means. So dementia is an umbrella group of diseases, and Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia.
Uh-huh, okay.
So you can killer dementia, you can have alcoholic dementia, and it's all about loss of brain cells. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating because it's something I hear regularly, what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia? So that's good to know. So Alzheimer's is a type of dementia, and there's a whole other stream of conditions that are under the dementia umbrella.
Exactly. Yep.
So I'd just like to talk about how CBD actually interacts with the endocannabinoid system, and there's been a bit of like dispute, at least in the past couple of years, saying how CBD interacts with it. Some believe it doesn't bind to receptors others say it interacts with an undiscovered receptor. I'd just like you to clarify that information.
Big question, because whatever I say now will change in a couple of years' time and I'll be wrong. Absolutely right that there is dispute on how it works. We originally thought that CBD activates the CB1 receptor. Now we know that CBD, I don't want to get too technical, but it's called a partial agonist. So what that means is it'll sit on the receptor and it won't do anything until it's called into action. And even when it is called into action, it only has almost half an effect on the cell. Does that sort of make sense? So as a partial agonist, it'll sit on the receptor and it will wait for our natural endocannabinoids to come onto the receptor. And when it does, it says, it's kind of like saying, okay, the brain is ready to activate the receptor and I'm going to help it to activate it. But I'm not going to go full on, because when we go full on, it causes detrimental effects. I'm just going to calm everything down. So it's almost like this regulator of the CB1 receptor. It's called a partial agonist.
Yeah, that was cool. Good question, Adam. Katrina, can we talk about, are there any negatives that we've found in CBD?
Any negatives of CBD?
As far as effects, so CBD, I mean, we hear so much positivity about its protective qualities, its anti-inflammatory properties, its lack of psychoactive activity. Have we found anything
In the work that I've been doing in my lab, and I'm sure there's others, I just haven't searched for it yet, is if you give CBD to healthy individuals, it can cause negative effects, mm-hmm. which really isn't a surprise, because if you give a medicine to someone who doesn't need a medicine, then it's going to cause negative effects. So I think the key with CBD is there's that much, there's a lot of good things that CBD can do, but there's also a lot of hype around CBD. And when you look at the States, for example, or in the UK, where they're infusing CBD into everyday foods because it's the cool sort of, you know, alternative health thing to do. You know, you can get a CBD latte in the States. You know, you should have CBD every day. You can get CBD in chocolate spread like Nutella and stick it on your toast of a morning. And, you know, recipes for CBD smoothies that, you know, are vegan and, you know, no sugar and all that sort of stuff, but they're jam-packed with CBD. You've just got to remember that CBD does change the brain, at least, and I'm sure it changes other things in the body as well. It does change the chemistry in the brain. So it is, by definition, it is psychoactive, okay? So there's this huge misconception that CBD is not psychoactive. Psychoactive means something that interacts with the brain and causes a change in behavior. Now, that can be psychoactive as in THC, interacts with the brain, gets you stoned, or it can be any other compound that is active in the brain in a good way and causes a change in behavior in a good way. So, for example, when we give CBD to kids with epilepsy, it's changing the brain and it's causing them to have improvements in their behavior. So that, by definition, is mentally psychoactive, yeah? So thinking about CBD as a medicine and as a psychoactive compound and then having it in your coffee every day is not all that great. So I think definitely there are detrimental things to do with CBD, but it's more around an inability, it's more around of a lack of understanding or a lack of recognition that CBD is a medicine.
Yeah, that's great information, and that's why it's so important for us to speak to people like yourself that have a deep, deep understanding of this, and you can put some of those misconceptions to bed. Yes, I really appreciate that information there, Katrina.
You're welcome.
I'm sure some of the listeners are still struggling to understand the endocannabinoid system and what it is. So, can you at its most basic sense, just describe what the endocannabinoid system is. And you mentioned receptors in the body. So what are these receptors? How can we describe it so that the person listening at home can get an understanding?
All right, so your body is made up of cells, and cells are basically spheres of kind of they've got kind of fat on the outside of them. So it's hard for certain things to get in and out of the cell, and this is the way the cell will regulate its own activity. Okay, so in our brain, we have brain cells called neurons and a couple of different other things, and we can activate or relax those cells to cause different functions. You know, so for me to move my arm, you know, I need to send a command from my brain down to my arm to do so. So that activity of certain parts of my brain that regulate my arm, yeah, to say it basically. So we don't want cells to be single units that are only working on their own. They need to interact with the rest of the community that is the human body or the human brain. So the way we do that is we have receptors on the surface of the cells that are there waiting for signals. So when a signal comes, it'll bind to the receptor and it'll tell the cell to do something, okay? So it's basically like the signal knocks on the door and the door doesn't open. Instead, the bouncer stands at the door and he's the receptor, he or she, and the bouncer says, no, you can't come in, but I'll pass on a message. Tell me what your message is. So the receptor then, with the bouncer, passes on the message into the cell, and the cell understands what it needs to do in response to that original message.
Yeah, that was great.
So
keep going. That's awesome.
So with the endocannabinoid system, endo means from within. So it's the cannabinoid system that we have inside us. All right. So the bouncers are mainly CB1 and CB2 receptors, and they both speak different languages. So if we activate the CB1 bouncer or the CB1 receptor, it'll send a certain message into the cell. If we stop the CB1 bouncer, that also sends a message. So the cell will detect that we've actually stopped that receptor. If we have CB2 receptors, that speaks a different language, so it's going to send a different signal into the cell. Or if we block it, it'll also send different, trigger different signaling systems within the cell, okay? Now, what usually happens is another cell will release the messenger. That messenger will go to the bouncer and the bouncer will cause an effect in the cell. But the endocannabinoid system doesn't play by those rules. The endocannabinoid system sends messengers from the membrane, so the outside of the cell. I don't know how to explain it.
You're doing great.
The endocannabinoid system doesn't play by the same rules as other chemical signals, because other chemical signals are released under the control of another cell, whereas the endocannabinoid signals, so the cannabinoid molecules that we make in our brain, so anandamide and 2-AG, they're actually made on demand. So they can just come out of the cell at any time and go and activate as a signaling system to the CB1 receptor. So they're not as tightly regulated by the brain as what, say, something like serotonin or dopamine is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. That's probably the best breakdown I've actually ever heard on that. I think you've done a great job of simplifying it, but giving us an understanding of what's actually going on in there. That was really cool. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do you have much knowledge on some of the lesser known cannabinoids, like maybe CBG, CBN, even THCV?
Yeah, so CBG, there's not a huge amount of work done on the minor cannabinoids. So CBG and CBDV, there's some evidence that in models of Huntington's disease and epilepsy that they're protective of the brain. So, you know, that may translate then to clinical trials later on down the track where we see whether we can actually help patients with epilepsy and Huntington's. CBC. So CBC works on that CB2 receptor that I was talking about. And there's a part of the back of the brain called the periaqueductal gray. Now, the periaqueductal gray is the part of the brain that determines how much pain we actually feel. So say you cut your finger, and some people who cut their finger may go, oh, that's I didn't even realize I had done that. And some people that cut their finger carry on, and there's all the theatrics and there's the tears and there's the drama. That's because the periaqueductal gray decided in the person who's making all the drama that that was a big deal. So it sends a signal to the rest of the brain to say, oh, my God, look what you've done. You've gone and hurt yourself. It's tremendously bad. So cannabinoid receptors are in this part of the brain that basically decide whether our pain is high or low, and it tells the rest of the brain and we become aware of that high or low pain. So CBC, cannabichromine, actually works on that periaqueductal gray. So that is an indicator that it may be really important as an analgesic, so as a pain medication for a number of different indications. But again, we need to progress on the research in order to understand how it works in humans. It's also anti-inflammatory, so in models of intestinal inflammation, so for example, colitis, which is an inflammation of the lining of the intestine, it is able to suppress that inflammation and help the gut to work properly. And it's also shown antidepressant properties. So it's amazing how these molecules that really aren't massively on the radar of science or medicine can actually have such vast, so from pain through to upset tummy through to, you know, antidepressant, such vast potential that we're only just starting to unlock.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I was speaking to my sister on the phone last night. She's had a series of health events in her younger adult years, and she was telling me last night that she's trying to retrain her brain to identify pain differently. She believes that she's feeling pain differently to the way other people would feel pain for the same condition. So does this link to that periaqueductal gray that you're talking about?
Listen to you being on neurosciencey. Yeah, definitely. So for people who experience chronic pain, it can turn into a situation where just even the slight pain is over-exaggerated, signaling is over-exaggerated to the brain. And, you know, pain is complex and the periaqueductal gray is just is a major player, but it's not the only player. But certainly the signalling from the periaqueductal gray to the brain can become distorted, and so our understanding of what's actually painful in our bodies is distorted as a result of that. So if your sister can retrain her brain through some way of, you know, in order to be able to learn to ignore those signals, that's a pretty amazing thing to be able to do. She must be very strong.
Well, she's just basically trying it, but she mentioned that somebody was describing it to her, and she wants to give it a crack, and she's trying to utilize terpenes in essential oils and things like that to see if she can get relief from some of the less pharmaceutical sort of methods to see if she can get some sort of result that way, because she's quite concerned about the number of scripts that she's having to fill, and she'd like to divert away from that if possible.
It's really understandable, and you hear about this a lot. You know, the pain medications that are available, while they're able to kind of treat the initial illness for a short period of time, to keep those pain medications going for a long period of time can be quite a challenge. They can become addictive, but then they also can stop working as well. So people dealing with chronic pain, it's a really difficult thing to be able to incorporate into your lifestyle. And so moving away from traditional medicine recommendations, but is certainly an understandable thing to do. Pinene, as I said before in my review that I'm publishing shortly, pinene has multiple benefits for pain, particularly inflammatory pain. So she may have some success with the reels that are pinene. Brain training and if aromatherapy works, then that's great. And as I said at the start, you know, our understanding of terpenes is so undervalued. And when you pull all the information together, even I just went, wow, there's so much evidence that, you know, this is an actual thing and it could actually be developed as a medicine.
Yeah, that's
so I think she's onto
that. Yeah, that's good feedback. She'll appreciate that. I think to wrap things up, Katrina, we've got cannabis. We have a whole range of other plants. Do you believe, does cannabis have a higher variety of terpenes, a higher quantity of terpenes? Why are we so fascinated with cannabis? Are there more terpenes in the one plant than maybe found in other plants? What's the story there? So why are we so focused on cannabis?
I think I can only speak for me. Mm-hmm. I'm so fascinated with cannabis because I believe in CBD. And if we can make plants that have specific terpene profiles along with CBD, which just seems to be the good guy in everything, we may be able to make chemovars, so different, certain chemical profiles, cannabis plants with certain chemical profiles that are best, for example, be assisted for pain. So, you know, high levels of pinene, high levels of CBD, whereas for epilepsy, it might be a different type of chemovar. For, you know, dementia, it might be a different type of chemovar. And I think that's my fascination with the plant, that it is so complex. And if you treat it nicely, you can get it to actually express very specific compounds that can, in a united way, help an illness. That's not to say that terpenes are higher in cannabis, because actually some of the cannabis chemovars don't express any of the terpenes that I'm interested in. I may as well go across to basil and rosemary and, you know, those sorts of things. But I think the key there is that the basil and rosemary don't have cannabidiol. So, you know, and they don't have the low levels of THC. So I think it's a combination of just getting those profiles right for specific illnesses that makes cannabis so appealing.
Yeah, so it's about the package. There's a lot there that you can explore, and you can get a lot out of the one plant potentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Katrina, this has been a fascinating chat. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah.
You've been a great guest, and we thank you very much for taking your time out to discuss this with us and our listeners. And nothing but appreciation. So thank you very much for putting your time out for us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on your show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Cantar. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Cantar strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.